All right, welcome to the Toon Shed, the workshop for everything from music, from history, from music, from history, what? Remix, theory, creative process, production, you name it. We're here to be better music listeners, better creators, and better music lovers. I'm your host, Blake Murray, and I'm here with my dear friend, Marty Gray. What is up, Marty? How about that intro?
Oh, it was a remix, wicka wicka. Hey, I'm your dear friend. That's right.
You are my dear friend.
Oh. We're dear friends since childhood.
Since childhood, you caught that I skipped the word childhood that time, yeah.
Oh, I didn't even catch it. I was just thinking about when we were 8 years old, and
wow.
Blake had a really cool drum set in his basement, and he would play it all the time, and he was taking drum lessons. And so then I asked my drummer dad for a drum set, and he wouldn't give me one until I was 13.
The difference between our parents is that my parents didn't know how annoying it would be, and your dad knew very well how annoying it would be.
Right. Can you imagine an 8-year-old on a drum set? Oh, my God.
I'm glad I didn't have any recording technology back then.
Hey, but you got pretty good at the drums, though.
Not bad. And you did, too. I remember when you got a kit. When did you get a kit? Did you just say?
I was 13. I felt like I had just started middle school or something. Or like maybe I was halfway through middle school. I don't know.
Kit was sick.
Oh, it was my dad. It was my dad. For all you drummer aficionados out there, it was a 1969 Ludwig leopard skin. And it was his drum set from his punk days.
Marty's dad was the truest of punks. He had a sweet gig at Marquette Mountain, which is not a mountain. It's just the smallest ski hill in the world. But once we found the video in high school, we were all freaking out. It was so cool.
It was cool.
Wait, wasn't he the singer in that? Or was he the drummer?
Yeah, no. So that was his band before he did punk. And he was the singer in that band. And he was just like ripping songs. I think, it was weird. Like growing up, my dad never sang, which was really weird because hearing him in that video was the only time I'd ever heard him sing.
Like, really?
Yeah, up until this day. I still have never heard him sing. Except for in that video.
Is he just not into it?
I don't know. Maybe he like gave it up like a monk or something.
Huh.
I'm not sure.
Your dad is sort of monk-like in some way.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is. Wait, so was he not an inspiration for you getting into singing? Because you're like the god of singing.
No, he didn't. Dude, I started, like, really singing sophomore year in high school.
Oh, my gosh.
I, like, didn't... Like, I always, like, did plays as a kid, but yeah. I never really knew... Like, I didn't know singing would be, like, the thing until I was, like, 15. Yeah, I had no idea.
Wow. That's awesome.
Yeah.
You have bloomed.
Must be genetic.
My chance. It's my chance. I get to brag about you. You've bloomed into a man who sang in front of Obama. Wow, you heard it here first.
That's true.
I've been waiting for this moment. I'm like, it'll just come up naturally.
Oh, man. That's
incredible.
True.
With the G-Men, right?
Yeah, with my college a cappella group, it was quite the time.
Wow.
It was great.
So cool.
He was a cool guy.
Did you shake his hand?
Yeah, I shook his hand and I shook Michelle's hand, and they talked about the University of Michigan game, which is the college I went to.
Mm.
They're like, "Oh, the Wolverines did pretty good last week."
Whoa, you're freaky good at that.
No,
you're freaky good at that.
It kind of sounded like Joe from Family Guy. It was bad. It was not good.
Wow, I thought it was good.
Oh, thanks, man.
At least an entertainment value. Anyways, speaking of a musical podcast transition, what's up today? What are we talking about?
Okay, so this is a music theory podcast.
Ooh, that's freaky.
Yeah, but it's okay. Don't be frightened though. Ironically enough, we're going to toss out a lot of music theory conventions as we always do. Right. I feel like whenever we talk about music theory, we're like, here are the rules and here's how to break them. You know?
That's all it's really about, right?
Yeah. So I guess before we get started, we need to set up the Jenga tower. So of course we can knock it down later. Knocking it down has always been and always will be more fun anyway. So we all know that there are chords in music, right? And they're built with ones, threes, and fives, right? The first scale degree, the third, and the fifth, right?
Beautiful.
So have you ever asked yourself, how does the chord get its name? Like, what makes a C chord a C chord? Aren't there more notes in the chord than C? Right?
It is a pretty big simplification of a chord to just call it C.
Right. It's like, well, C has C, E, and G. Like, it has all three of those. So why call it C? Especially if... So if you're in the key of C and you play G, why is it called G? Like, why isn't it called B or D? Well, because the way the chord is set up is just a series of thirds, and the first third at the bottom of the stack is always the name of the chord, right?
So it's like me and my two brothers, Blake, Shale, Neil, but Neil was, I guess, technically first because he was the oldest, so you could just call us the Neil chord.
Yeah, that would be the Neil chord.
And perfect analogy. Nailed
it. And you would be the most unimportant part of that chord as the fifth.
You know, Neil and I used to argue, like, who was first. He's like, dude, I was born before you. It's clear I'm first. I'm like, yeah, but, like, when we stand in a line, I'm on the left because I'm the shortest. Like, I don't know. It never worked out. I always lost that argument. But I still, like, put up a fight because I was like, I need to fight him. He's my brother. It's like,
that's true.
Be impolite.
That's true. Yeah, and fights between you three were always very intellectual. They're always very, like, philosophical fights. a lot of people saying, well, actually, it was fun to watch. Well, anyway, the root of the chord is what gives the chord its name, right? Okay. And the reason for that is because that's where our ear gravitates to, as tonally trained people, right? So if we play like C, F, G, we wanna, here's the root, bamana, here's the da, 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 right? Our ear is naturally gravitating towards the strongest member of the chord. And this is obviously reductionist and oversimplified and a pretty, you know, slapped together version of classical theory. But it goes like this. If your ear is naturally gravitating towards that, really what the bass is supposed to do is play the root of each chord, with exceptions. Right? So if I'm the bass, here's the bass. Da, 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 da. Yeah, you know its sound. You know how that sounds, right?
Yeah, so familiar.
Super strong. Oh, yeah. Right. And obviously, the note is always played by the bass instrument. The strong part of the chord is always played by the bass instrument. On piano, that's my left hand, which is the lowest part of the, you know, of my hands. If you're playing a guitar, it's the lowest string, whatever string is striking the lowest note. You're kind of getting a picture, right? The lowest note is the one that matters. It is the one that outlines the root of the chord, right? It is the strongest thing. Now, there are exceptions to this rule, especially in Western classical theory, with a first inversion tonic note being the best example. And I won't go too deep into this, but there's a way to sort of go back home, quote unquote, so to speak, without going back home. So if you want a chord structure that doesn't sound very final, you can not hit the root note with the bass, but instead hit the third. And I'll sort of demonstrate. So if you have, right, 1-4-5-1. If you want to continue, if you want to sort of continue the chord pattern, you don't want the first time you hit one to sound strong. So you would go like this. You would hit the third instead. Here it comes.
Ooh, it is a little bit, it's like light on your toes.
And now we're there.
Mm.
Right, so if you
hit... sorry to talk over, but yeah, it was kind of, the first one was sort of like light on the toes feeling, and then the second one is really the, I am here.
Oh, absolutely.
I'll praise the king.
Yep, yep, we have arrived. We have arrived. You know, and I won't explain too much how that works. It's cool, it's interesting, but it's kind of one of the rules we're going to break today, right? Is that,
okay.
Now this is, we have to keep in mind, this is conventional Western harmony, right? By the book, in order for harmony to work, the third and the fifth have to be there, right? So all of these notes have to be there in order for it to work. The chord isn't C major without all three of these members. If the fifth is not there, it's not C major. Now, it's really not C major. It's just an open fifth, right? If the fifth is heightened, it's a different chord altogether. Right, that's A minor.
Wait,
first inversion.
Heightened?
Oh, just one up one whole step.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yep. That is A minor first inversion. That's not the same thing, right? So it's very yeah. strict. Of course, those of you that study jazz or study more modern theories have been yelling at me that the fifth doesn't need to be there. The fifth doesn't technically need to be there. Yes, that is true. In jazz theory, the fifth doesn't need to be there. And around the Romantic period and the postmodern period, the fifth started to not be considered a chord member, right? But Western conventional harmony says the fifth has to be there for a chord to be a chord, right?
Mm. And that's kind of interesting. Sorry, just a quick aside. So it's like if you're playing C major, which is C, E, and G, and then you just say, okay, I'm going to drop that G. Now you're just playing C and E.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're just playing it for us, I mean, that could be part of A minor. That could be part of C major. That could be part of actually a whole bunch of chords. But usually, I guess, in the context of music, you could sort of feel which chord you're going for or like one might be more appropriate. But sometimes it'd still be ambiguous. So technically, you can't name it. Okay, this is definitely C major. We have a C and an E here. It's obvious, you know. It's like, oh well, they could be going for A minor, and then you know, then you're splitting hairs. But
of course,
it's just kind of interesting how you do need all the parts to sort of like label it in a way if you want to be 100% clear.
Yeah, yeah, that's a really good point. And I will note that during the Renaissance vocal era, most notably the works written by folks like Palestrina. He would often end songs with just this, no fifth. But that wasn't at the time considered a chord, or at the time it was called a tetrachord. It wasn't considered a C major chord. It had a different name in Latin. So I want to cover all my bases. But in you know, at the height of classical music theory, in counterpoint, we do need that fifth there most of the time, with a few exceptions, right? So
okay.
The whole idea here is that in music production, we can toss out the very concept of building chords with thirds and fifths, right? What if I told you that the root was the only thing that mattered in production? When you're writing instruments, or really the lowest thing, whatever it is. And in my case, it's the left hand. Right here. This low burp. This low thing is the only thing that matters in music production.
You know, I actually find it kind of relieving. I don't know what you're going to say after this, but I love it because I feel like every time I go to write a song, I'll like, okay, write some chords. I'm thinking about it. You know, probably overthinking it. I get a progression that I'm like, okay, I just got to move on. I like this enough. And then I start adding other notes and sounds and, you know, I'm just playing around. And then at the end of the day, I look at all the notes and I'm like, uh-oh, I'm kind of lost. Like, I'm not really following this chord progression. I'm just sort of using my ear, but sometimes ignoring it. And sometimes I'm like, wait a minute, these things don't go together. And then I end up going back through everything. But actually, a lot of times I've been pleasantly surprised. It's just like, well, I've added a bunch of notes and it sounds fine. I have no idea what chords I'm playing anymore. But I'm hoping that whatever you're going to say next is going to help me sort of root myself. Haha.
Blake,
understanding what I'm doing.
You have this incredible ability to see the future, to see exactly where I'm going with this whole
yes!
idea.
You are
on the freaking money. It's perfect. Yes. This is the idea.
Gryffindor.
The only thing, are you a Gryffindor?
I mean, probably. I feel like I'm like generally a little bit courageous and like a little bit dumb, or like I don't think through my plans fully, and that just like screams Gryffindor to me, so I can't really say I'm anything else.
You are ridiculously loyal, I will say that.
Oh yeah, loyal.
You are ridiculous. You know what's annoying?
Putting things in a good light.
I always take those quizzes, like you know, friends always send you quizzes. I always take those quizzes, and I can't seem to not get Slytherin every time. And I'm like, it's so irritating. And every time,
even if you're like trying to like say like, okay, what's your favorite animal? And you're like, not snakes.
Right, you're right. And you're like, I obviously won't pick green or snakes, or power. I won't answer. You know, they're like, what is your ideal? And I'm like, don't answer power.
Do you slick your hair back?
Oh God. They always try to patronize you too. At the end, they're like, don't worry, Slytherin isn't a bad thing. It's actually pretty great. And I'm like, shut up.
It's just bad in the one story that explains what Slytherin is.
Exactly.
But like outside of that story, there's a whole community of Slytherins who are great people.
Oh God, yep. They try to make you feel better. Like, I know I'm the villain. Whatever, I'm fine.
You're a great villain. You own the part.
Thanks, man. Well, so really the whole idea that you're getting at is yes. The thing that grounds it all, that gives the chord and the texture its definition and its harmonic movement, is the lowest thing. In production, that's the 808, the sub, whatever you want, or the bass guitar, the left hand of the synthesizer, whatever you're using, it's the lowest note. The lowest element is what you need to pay attention to. Anything else, as long as it's in the key, can work. And there are specifics that we'll get into, right? This should be another way of thinking about harmony and writing without being bound to Western theory conventions, right? And the reason why we're doing this episode at all is because I know a lot of music writers that get stuck with chords and they feel like they have to follow chord writing, right? They have to use the third and fifth of every voice. And they, you know, a lot of these people, if they write a lot of music, they're familiar with sus2, you know, they're familiar with adding a major seven. Like they're familiar with those fun additions, right? But the whole idea is to break away from the structure of having to think about chord structure at all and just think about what the bass is doing, right? And I'm not saying that you should think about production this way all the time, you know, just throw out all of your Western theory, just throw out chords altogether. But it can be a fun exercise when you are trying to make something more amalgamous or make a texture that's thicker or less musically defined. I don't know, something interesting.
Yeah.
It's just another tool.
And actually, something that's coming to mind is, you know, you're playing these sort of classical chord progressions and talking about the history of the stuff a little bit, where it comes from. And I feel like there's been this trend sort of, you know, in, I don't even know, the last 50 years, 100 years, something, where it's like we're a little bit shifting from focusing on, okay, what's the harmonies, what's the chords, what's this, to adding more timbres or different sound types. You know, you listen to... You know, there's tons of songs that are just using two chords, four chords, the same four chords. There's that little bit on YouTube about, oh, look, you could play 100 pop songs, the same four chords. But what makes all those songs actually different is, you know, all the drum sounds, all the layers, all the different bass sounds, all the guitar sounds, the singer's voice, you know, like they're adding all this texture to it. And I feel like that's almost like people are playing with that a little bit more in music than the harmonies, which they used to play with quite a bit. You know, it was like all the crazy composers would do these crazy harmonies and amazing counterpoint where you have like 15 lines moving together and creating this beautiful thing. And they're just different, a little bit of a different focus, it feels like.
Oh yeah. And yeah, you're getting at something really important, that like we're living in the computer age where you're able to manipulate sound waves so easily. So of course everyone is playing with texture.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And timbre and it makes sense, right? It's like that is the most interesting, tangible, fungible thing.
Yeah.
It's
such a good point. And you know, another thing that came up in a conversation, this is just a little bit of a side now, is someone was saying like, why have all music seems like it's genre mashing a little bit more. I was like, well, that's kind of true. I think it's actually because of how connected we are through the internet and through travel, and we're just more connected as a species than ever before. So those ideas are getting around more than ever before. But I know it's a little off topic, but I meant to ask you, like, what do you think, Marty? Is that sort of like why genres are mashing together? Is that a good enough answer for you, or is there more to it?
That's a good enough answer for me. No, and I think to just add on your observation, I think another reason why it feels like genres are sort of super muddy is because it's so easy to make music in most genres now. It's just so easy to make music. So it's easy to hear a country song and be like, I can do that. I have a guitar, you know, and you really can. Like at the end of the day, if you have good practice, good recording techniques, like you can do that. You know, that wasn't possible 20 years ago.
Yeah, actually the access is crazy. You know, if you have like a DAW, like a, you know, some sort of software, you have more power than they did 20 years ago, in the best studios in the world, right? I don't even know if it was 20, maybe it might just be 10 years ago at this point, but it's probably closer to 20, but don't quote me on that.
Who knows?
But yeah, the access to the tools to make music and listen to music is definitely just increasing, and may it increase more and more.
Yep, I agree. It's an exciting time to make music. It really is.
Anyways, yeah, sorry to go way off track there. What were we talking about? The bass.
Oh, I forget. Oh, yeah. Okay, so now the music. Let's pull out the piano. This is a music theory episode, so of course we have our piano out, which is always fun. It is my principal instrument for harmony. So we're in the key of G flat because I like black keys. I don't have to think too much. I can just touch black keys. Also, it's useful at the end. So if we were to begin with conventional chords, right? Here's G flat, E flat minor. That's six. B major. You know what's coming. D flat major, baby. That's 1, 6, 4, 5. That is. Right? That's your chord progression. Right?
Slaps.
And it's still, I mean, the vibe is different. You change the vibe a little bit and it's modern, but the same chord progressions still stick around, right? So
great example.
Thank you very much. If we were to set up an ostinato, say, which is a fancy Italian term for something that doesn't change in music, right? Just this open fifth, easy. We don't really have to change that for the ear to know that it's that chord progression, right? We haven't done anything to let the ear know that it's 1, 6, 4, 5. But the minute we add the bass, then we're there. Then we have chords. We have harmonic movement. Your ear knows that chord progression. Your ear knows what's happening. The only thing we've given your ear is the lowest note, the bass. That's it.
Huh. That's the proof right there.
That's the dude. Proof is in the pudding.
It's in the bass.
It's in the bass. The proof is in the bass.
The pudding's in the bass.
Well, See, to prove that this is real and that it's not just a fun trick that we can do with open fifths, which is lovely, we can add the second. Here's that A flat. Oh my god, I love this. I love this shape. I use this shape a lot in my own music, but it's still not chords, right? You can do anything you want. That's all the upper stuff. That's all upper stuff, but that still doesn't give us chord information. You're hearing that lowest note. Your ear keeps hearing one over and over again. There's no harmonic movement. No matter what we do up there, you only hear harmonic movement when the bass comes in, right? Now you hear movement. Right?
Ooh.
The bass is the most important part. You can even do this.
That is so cool.
Oh, yeah, right? It's... I think you'll start to hear this all over in all the music that you listen to. That there's just... There's random tones happening, right? There's random chord members happening all over the place. In the vocals, in random string textures and synth textures, whatever. There's all sorts of stuff. Huh. You could even play the tonic. You could even play this over and over again. The bass is still strong.
Wow.
Right? It doesn't matter. Your ear hears four,
yeah.
Five. Like, it can't help
My
it.
My mind's kind of blown right now. Like, I always know, like, the bass holds down the fourth, but I'm like, oh, yeah, it's because the bass and the drums are, you know, it's kind of like... They're doing the rhythm together and the bass is like outlining the chord. And now it's like, wait a minute, like the bass is actually dictating the chord.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Like kind of controlling the whole progression. Because like, it's not like I hear the harmonies when you're playing those bass notes, but it is an implied movement where like when you were just doing stuff with your right hand up high and like kind of soloing up there a little bit, I didn't really hear any movement.
Right.
I felt static in a way because you're just, you know, you're hanging out on that one spot.
Oh yeah, right. And like, just to prove that what you're talking about is actually a thing, we'll start by going back to this 1-2-5 thing. We'll play a couple rounds of the form, right? Now hear how this just... Hear how suspenseful that is. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. That's wild. There's so many ways to prove it. I was sold after the first one, but then each one after that like just hit me even harder. It was incredible.
Right. Well, it's like you really can't mess up with that philosophy.
Like, there's no wrong notes, you know, just hold down your harmonies with your bass. And
there
then...
really isn't. You really don't even have to do an ostinato. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have to keep playing the same note. You could just play random, like I could just play all the black keys. I could just do this. Throw in a random B in there. Whatever you want, and then... It doesn't matter. It as long as it's in the key, the bass is gonna move the song. It's gonna move whatever chord, and it doesn't matter what chords that you choose. Obviously, you could.
Huh. Wow. You know, this is so interesting. Ooh. I was like, wait a minute, where are we going?
Spicy.
This is so interesting because I'm somebody, just personally, I've never really had the best ear for like picking out notes and things. And one thing I've noticed, I think the number one thing I can hear if you play a chord is what's the highest note. Just sort of like a melody, you know, sometimes, not all the time, but a lot of times, I guess, is usually the highest note or a higher note, and it's sort of easy to pick out because of that. I think the second easiest thing for me to pick out is the bass note. And, you know, I might be wrong. They might be reversed, but it's sort of interesting how both those have so much power, but it's a different type of power, you know? Like, my ear might go to the melody first, but the bass is really the thing that's going to change things, you know, whether the rest of the piece likes it or not. It's sort of like it's in charge.
Oh, that's yeah, that's astute. That's incredible. I mean, the melody is in charge of so much, right? And I feel like you're right, that the bass is in charge of the opposite dynamic, you know?
Wow. It's like two sides of a coin or something, if you really want to.
It really is. So I want to quickly say that this sort of thinking works with limited capacity the minute you start using notes that are not in the scale. And I say with limited capacity because it obviously doesn't work if you're here and you try, right? That obviously doesn't work. But if you know what you're doing and you use minimal color in the mid-range or in the right hand, right? If you stick to this open fifth, this is very minimal harmonic information. You can do some surprising things with the bass, right? You can step down chromatically, for example.
Huh.
That's literally just stepping down chromatically. You know? But it...
So- I'm questioning, why does that work? Like, well, why can't you just play anything in the bass, but like doing chords or chromatic stuff works?
Well, it works because when you use very little harmonic information in the right hand or in the mids, you give the bass less opportunity to clash, right? And the ear sort of implies a lot of really cool things, right? So just to demonstrate the theory behind this, I'll play the open fifth. I'll play that same thing again. I'll actually play it in a higher register so you can hear it a little better. But here's an open fifth, and then here's the bass. Right? That's just chromatic down. But when you add, let's say, the third and the second, right? Beautiful chord. You give the bass more opportunities to clash disgustingly with what's going on up here. So I'll play the same bass line. Yuck.
Yeah. It ends up feeling a bit messy.
Yeah. Yeah, rather too cluttered. Huh. So if you're going to experiment with off-key bass stuff, lighten up your texture in the mid-range. Boom.
You know, I'm drawing an analogy here too. You're like, you know, this isn't always the case too. We should just stop saying that. It's always not always the case. But you think about a solo in a band. Someone has a solo, like, you know, let's just say it's a jazz group. A lot of times, not always, but people will get a little bit quieter, and that's obviously so you can hear the soloist better. But I wonder if it also sort of frees them up harmonically a little bit to go off without as much clash, just because you might even be hearing the band a little bit less. It's a slightly different thing, but just that's what it brought to mind.
Oh yeah, that's a really good observation too. Yeah, if the in a jazz setting, the upright bass, or the lowest note, can only play one note. And if a saxophonist is really going off the rails and using a bunch of extended theory stuff, yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. The pianist is going to kind of back off the texture a little bit. They're really only going to play like if the song is going, they're only going to really go. You've heard them do that.
Yes, exactly, yes. I've never heard a piano without the soloist.
They're just tickling. Yeah, they're just tickling the key. They're just implying. They're just like ushering the movement along, but not getting in the way too much.
But giving that space is so important to like let the other artist, you know, shine without The Clash, you know?
Oh, yeah. I guess I've never really, like, put those two ideas together.
Yeah, I've always thought of it sort of conceptually as, like, oh, you want literal, like, A-U-R-A-L, aural space for the, you know, other person to play their instrument and be heard. But it's like, wait a minute, maybe the actual harmonic information clashes too.
Oh, yeah.
Or could clash.
That's 100%. Hmm. Yeah, the theory kind of extends beyond production. Like, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, like, all of this extended stuff is really important. So, I mean, that kind of gets us back into the production sphere. You know, like, how do we think about this in the production sphere? So, if you have two different instruments or two different areas of your production, I like to call them the mid-ranges. I consider that, like, acoustic guitar, electric guitar, pads, synths, whatever, anything that's sort of vaguely mid-rangey, and I distinguish that from the bass or the sub or the 808 or the bass guitar, whatever, the lowest thing, right? So I actually have, we're going to transition away from Pianoville into Synthville. Synthville. Yummy, yummy. This is just a Juno, right? This is a Juno patch. Not a real Juno. I'm not rich, but this is a fake Juno. This is just an easy little pad you could program on an 80s synth. And then on my other keyboard here, I have a sub.
How many keyboards you got over there?
I just have two. I have my little, like, cheap Impact GX61, like my 61 key thing. And then I have an M Audio Oxygen 25. For anyone well-versed in MIDI keyboards, you just heard me admit that I bought the cheapest possible option in both.
Hey, if it sends a MIDI signal in, that's all you need.
That's what I'm saying. It doesn't matter. But I have two keyboards here, and we're going to... I like to split the keyboards up so we can think about this in practice. Right, we can hold down the pedal of the pad and just touch a bunch of black keys. Right, that's just mush. Right, that's G flat major black key mush. Doesn't matter. But the minute we press this other keyboard, right?
Yep.
And we can just keep holding down. We can add that stuff on top. We could get some guitars going. It doesn't matter what you add up there, the bass is going to move that texture along.
What a jam. I was so tempted to, like, beatbox, but I was like, I'll never be able to sync up the audio.
I know. I wish I could play way more instruments at once, like Marc Rebier does, but I can't.
That was incredible. That was awesome. Vibe in 1 second.
Oh, yeah. I mean, really, the idea... putting the other thing down. The idea is, if you feel like it, you should say, screw it, I'm not going to be restricted by trying to figure out the chords. I'm just going to try making textures and colors, right? Imagine the freedom that this can bring you in the DAW, right?
Mm.
Especially if you're not as quick with music theory as some of your friends or some of the people you watch online. Like, this can be really fun for someone making, like, ambient music. Or just wanting to make, like, more textural, atmospheric pop music who doesn't want to think about chord structure as much.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. So, I guess, what about the scenario where, okay, let's say I'm making a song. Let's say it's, like, just I want to make a pop song, or I want to make some electronic music kind of thing. And I do this with the bass, and I'm like, okay, the song sounds pretty good, but I actually want to spice up the bass line and have it be more than just one note here and there. How do you like keep that emphasis? Because now the bass is holding down the chords, but you also want it to do some of the, I guess, kind of more melodic type of stuff. So how do you balance that? Do you just have to keep the emphasis on those big notes too, or is there other ways, or?
Ooh, that's a good question. So I think this kind of mode of thinking works the best if the bass is on the root of the chord at all times, right? Because that's what your ear is going to hear.
Yeah, solidifies
However,
it for your ear.
yeah, it really does. The minute you start drifting away from the root of the chord, it becomes a little weaker. Now, that isn't necessarily a bad thing, and there are so many different scenarios. So you should use your ear, obviously. But I will say, it can really help when you set up the verse or the chorus of a song with really strong root-centered bass first, and you get the earworm in the listener's ear. And then on the second chorus or the second verse or the second time around that same pattern, if it's a strong enough section of the song, you can start doing things with the bass that are more intricate, and the listener will have that chord structure sort of like subliminally etched into their brain. Does that make sense? That's a really weird and like pedantic way of explaining that idea, but
No, that totally makes sense. And it just reminded me of an analogy to another musical thing, which is like the difference between beat and rhythm. So if, like if I'm playing a beat that's like boom, chip, chet, boom, chip, chet, you kind of hear the beat as like that bass drum, which funny enough is the lowest thing in that, like boom, 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 boom. That's what you're feeling is the beat. But then the rhythm has chet, chet, you know, all those other parts to it. And you can actually do it where you don't have that bass drum there at all. And you still feel that beat. Like that's where the pulse is. That's how you'd fist bump to it, right? But isn't that kind of the same as this thing here? Like you can sort of set up a really strong sense of beat or pulse by saying, okay, here's the notes, you know, here's our chords. And then as you drift away from that a little bit, if you have it set up strong enough, then the listener can kind of just infer that harmonic information.
That's exactly right. Isn't it funny how the same sort of theory works with drums too? Like the kick
So weird.
drum dictates the com the like the feel of the drum pattern.
Yeah,
It's
it's
weird.
so
It's like the
weird.
lowest thing is what are you? It's kind of arbitrary if you don't think about it in a intellectual way. It's arbitrary, right? Like why doesn't the highest thing dictate harmonic movement? You know? Why not?
No clue.
It doesn't make
Absolutely no
sense.
clue. Is it just like history?
I
Like
don't
some old school
know.
composers just decided, and then we heard it a million times, and we're like, yeah, that's right.
I have no idea. You know, if you talked to an acoustician or like a real scientist, I'm sure they could tell you, well, you know, it has to do with the harmonic spectrum and the way that we hear
How your
things as a
ear,
human. Yeah, I don't know.
your brain.
Yeah, right. Someone who has studied neural things, I'm sure they could explain. I can't explain. I don't know.
Yeah, no, it gets real complicated. Actually, there's a lot of okay, slight nerd aside here. There's a book by Steven or Stefan Pinker that has some it's called This Is Your No. It's called something about music. Just look up his name in music, you'll see it. It's so long, all about the brain. And I was reading it was so thick, so dense, those kind of ideas in it. And then he said that music was just sort of like a fart of evolution, like it happened on accident, and like the way you can remember music like crazy, and that we all have these similarities and understanding of music, and the connection is all just a total accident of evolution. And I one, don't buy that, and two, was just so offended. I put the book down right there. I was like, I already can't read this because it's too technical and dense, and then you just offended me. But I bet there's some cool ideas in there that maybe a more mature Blake could get after.
Oh, I'm
But,
sure. See, that's the thing that we should talk about. Like, we should do an episode where we just sit down and talk about like why we think music is the way it is.
it's so strange.
Isn't it
Like, how
weird?
can singers remember the lyrics to like thousands and thousands of songs? There's nothing I can remember thousands and thousands of.
True. Or like,
Maybe like individual words, but like, I don't know.
oh my God. And why do we even like kick drums? Why do we like bass so much? It's just like that. Those sort of things are endlessly fascinating. I feel like we should talk about that.
Yeah, we got to put that on the list.
Yeah, that's true. And why does the lowest note matter? Why does that feel right? You know, I really couldn't explain to you why that makes sense. But yeah. I mean, you heard it. It makes sense, right?
It absolutely does. And I'm actually really excited to try this. I kind of want to go through maybe some of my old songs or just build a new song that has this idea in it and try making it as thick as possible and then as thin as possible and like sort of push those boundaries. Like it's a whole thing on its own just to mess with.
Yeah, it really is. Well, that's pretty much all I had. Start making those textures and colors, kids.
Sweet. Yeah, it's probably good that every musician at some point just like makes an ambient song, at least one.
Yeah, or
it's a good first project.
Oh yeah, and if you're a musician with some friends who own a synthesizer, go over and have a cool synthesizer ambient jam.
Oh, you know, pretty fun.
Oh, it's great.
Turn it up loud in a small room.
Oh yeah,
just like literally feel it. Which why is that fun? We'll have to get into that.
Yeah, dude.
There's definitely things that like music, like the waves, like shake your body in a way that probably sends some signals to your brain. Like some of your nerves are probably like, whoa.
Yeah, it's got
to. That does, but that's my guess.
It's got to be left over from campfire days, you know?
Yeah, somewhere. Campfire days. You know, okay, so one last thing that was on my mind and I kind of skipped over, speaking about the link between rhythm and harmony. This blew my mind when I saw it for the first time, and you've probably seen this before, Marty, but like, okay, let's say you have two kick drums, and let's say you're playing one and I'm playing one, and then we play a polyrhythm. So let's say over the course of the same amount of time, you play three evenly spaced notes and I play four evenly spaced notes, and then you speed that up. There's certain rhythms that actually turn into chords, like faster than we could actually play on a kick drum. It'd have to be a computer, but you speed it up crazy and it's essentially like the same thing as like the string on your guitar waving,
mm-hmm,
with like two strings waving together. They make pitches, right? So it's like these funny polyrhythms that people play really slow in music sometimes and can be fun to dance to, and or just kind of like a fun thing to listen to because they kind of throw you off, right? Those are actually like chords and harmonies just slowed down. Like there's a literal link between them.
Yes, we're getting into the harmonic spectrum. We have to do a harmonic spectrum episode soon.
Absolutely.
The harmonic series. Oh, we gotta do it.
We gotta do it. It's time. Well, actually, wait. We try to cycle through like the theory, the songwriting, the different topics. So maybe it'll be a second, but maybe we'll be too excited and it'll be next time.
Maybe. Who knows?
There's no way to know. All right, cool. Well, let's call it there, Marty. Any last thoughts to leave us with?
Go download a fake Juno. It's worth it.
Download a fake Juno. You heard it here, hopefully first.
Hopefully first.
Email us at thetuneshedpodcast@gmail.com. Send us your thoughts. We want to hear from you. We make this for our listeners. And much love to y'all. Catch you next time.
Bye. It's a Juno.